Hi, this is Tamsin Granger.
This is Dan Abuhoff.
With Tamsin and Dan Read the Paper. It's Sunday,
October
15, 2017.
And we're exhausted.
We're exhausted. We have just been on the Tinicum Covered Bridge bike ride.
Right. 55 miles.
55 miles. Yeah. That seemed like 105.
Yeah, it did.
And it's a lot of hills. A lot of hills. Covered bridges.
That's right.
I know, covered bridges are charming.
Right.
But the thing is, they're at the bottom of a hill.
Right.
And then you've got to claw your way back up out of the bridge.
Covered bridges are at sea level. Go figure.
So
you can hardly ride over the bridge, and then you got to go straight
uphill.
That's
a lot of work. But we made it.
We're here. That's the important
thing.
A lot of people wouldn't do a podcast this week.
Right.
Lesser mortals. But we're here, and it will be reflected in the quality of the podcast.
Girded ourselves to the task.
That's right. We are. It's going to be a little less dynamic in some ways, but we think more thoughtful.
It's been a busy week anyway.
It has.
This is the week that I meet students from Bucks County Community College in New York.
Your students.
At the Met.
Your own students.
My students.
You've met them already.
I'll meet any students. I'm not fussy.
But you know these students.
I just hang out there by the front door of the Met.
But you arrange that you say to them, here's your chance to see a real museum with a guided tour by Ms. Tamsin Granger, your teacher. And that's what happens, right? And
that's not exactly the way I put it.
The
department arranges a bus. Oh. To take anybody who will pay the fee, which is nominal,
mm-hmm.
Into New York from Pennsylvania.
And these kids haven't been to New York, a lot of them.
And many of them have not.
Right.
And
drops
them off in Chelsea to go to galleries.
Well.
Then picks them back up again and makes another stop at the MoMA, the Museum of Modern Art.
Mm-hmm.
And then makes a third stop up at the Met. The mm-hmm. Met's open late on Fridays.
Right.
And so then the bus picks everybody up at the Met.
And takes them
at like 7:45 and drives all the way back.
Well, it's a full day for them and for you.
Yeah.
But you had a record number.
I didn't have a record number, but we had a great time.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that I've mentioned on the podcast before, that I love the samurai armor and masks and helmets and so forth. And one of my students actually knew a great deal about the history of those. And so I learned a lot and I really enjoyed that.
Yeah. Well, look, you described to me in great detail who was there. You kind of an interesting crew of folks, and this is an exposure they'd never otherwise have. They didn't take your
course. I wouldn't go that far.
Oh, it seems obvious to me.
New York is a pretty well-known place.
And yet?
People will get
there. And yet, how many of them have never been?
A good time was had by
most
of us, shall we say.
Okay.
And while we were in New York, we had an excellent walk in Central Park, which is just
that's
beautiful.
We being you and me, Friday
me
morning.
And you,
yes.
Yeah. Right. And we also went to a play.
We're reeling backwards. That was Thursday night. Taking you back in time. Yes, Thursday night we were at the theater. We were at Laura Pell's Theater. It's part of their Roundabout subscription. And we saw a play called The Last Match.
I was dubious.
Yes.
It's about tennis.
Well, there are many reasons to be dubious. Whenever the Roundabout puts on something that's not by George Bernard Shaw, it's trouble.
You are such a hater. I can't even believe this.
I'm overstating it. But they take a chance sometimes on some new plays, and it doesn't always work. And even some old plays. The one we saw just a few
time
weeks.
Time in the Conways.
Time in the Conways was not a good time. But the last match, it turns out, is not something that they commissioned. It's a special kind of trouble. What it is a play that was successful, I presume it was successful, staged in London.
Right.
And came over
here.
At
the Old Globe.
And more to the point, it's about tennis.
Well,
let's say
it's by.
Oh, sure.
Anna Ziegler.
A woman named Anna Ziegler, who you've never heard of. A young playwright. But let me just read a few lines from the program. There's always an excited description of the play. This gives you a good sense of what the goal was here in terms of this undertaking. Here's how the play is described. Set during the semifinals of the U.S. Open, The Last Match takes us on a riveting journey into the minds of two athletes who in their pursuit of their dreams have shaped their lives around the obligations of their game. With an electricity of storytelling, Anna Ziegler unpacks the monumental pressures and aspirations that drive each shot in the tennis court, exploring the sacrifices made by some of the world's biggest sports stars in the name of ambition. That's what the play's about.
All right.
And you say to that, okay, and how's she going to do that? And the way they do that is they have the two main characters dressed in tennis garb, and they act out, in many ways, tennis motions. I mean, they are looking at each other. They're going through forehands and backhands and hopping around this way and that way without a tennis racket, without a tennis ball. But
with sound effects.
With some sound effects, and in a way that very much reflects and suggests real tennis. And as they do this, they conduct sort of an interior dialogue, not interior monologue, an interior dialogue in which they're kind of talking to each other but thinking back and forth to each other. I'm not describing it well because it seems impossible that it could actually work, but it does.
It did work. And actually, the director, Gay Taylor Upchurch, did a great job choreographing this tennis play. Turns out she has a background in dance, which is not a surprise.
No, because
it really did work.
Movement is a huge sport.
Seems like a tennis match.
Well, it's a combination. It was like 1 + 1 = 3. It's the combination of the movement on the court on the one hand, and some very snappy, insightful, revealing monologue, interior dialogue going on at the same time. Funny, insightful, all draws you in, and it does work. Even a skeptic like me had to say, this stuff is interesting. It does work. So does that mean it's a great play?
First of all, can we just say that the set was good, too?
Set was good, too.
It conveyed the notion of being
in a stadium.
Tennis stadium.
And it had an electronic scoreboard.
It had two scoreboards.
Which would help, because the score mattered. You have to keep
mind. So it was well staged.
Right.
Absolutely well staged.
There's a lot going for it.
Yes.
Was it a great play?
I enjoyed it, but you have your doubts.
I enjoyed it too.
It's amazing I enjoyed it because I don't really enjoy tennis.
Here's the problem with it. Here's why it wasn't better.
Be careful here.
Here's why it's not great.
Here.
I'm not going to be. There's no problem here. The problem is that perhaps it's the way it went. I don't know, but I can imagine that this woman Anna Ziegler perhaps knows something about tennis and wrote this this gee whiz excellent play about. It takes place very much tied to a tennis backdrop.
It's an older champion.
Yeah, that's right. Older champion, older American champion.
Yes, playing against the young upcoming
Russian, I guess.
Russian player.
It's almost as
so contrasting their place
and an established champion like Federer, except the Federer as an American.
Yeah,
and with the upcoming player, many upcoming players, Eastern European would fit that mold.
Yeah.
Trying to unseat him. And there are all kinds of interesting themes. The problem is this. The problem is couldn't let well enough alone. If the play was just that what we described, if it was wound around these two characters and tennis and the two of them and their lives as they relate to tennis, it would have been well worth seeing and it would not have been a dull moment. The problem is somebody said to Anna Ziegler, perhaps, you need more. You need to bring it out a little more. It needs to be a little more substantial, a little longer, a broader appeal. And the result is you have two additional characters. One is the girlfriend of one tennis player and the wife of another.
Yeah.
And without spending too much time on it and being too negative, in my mind, the wife of the American player was an incredible buzzkill. I don't mean to blame the actress. I think it's the character. It's hard to pull that apart. But they spent more and more time on issues that she had, and it was not written with the same spark, with the same clarity, with the same insight. And in the play, whenever it went to her, would grind to a halt. And it became increasingly noticeable, so much so that you almost felt that if you had a chance to spend 15 minutes with Anna Ziegler and you said, here's a thought, just erase every piece of dialogue involving this character and the character and have it a three-person play. It doesn't have to be perfectly balanced because the other girlfriend worked well. A little shorter, see what you've got. Well, that's not going to happen. Right. And so you have what I would call not a whole loaf. Maybe it's more than half a loaf. You have some very interesting stuff and some very conventional, not interesting stuff mashed together.
Would you recommend it?
I would recommend it, but I don't think it's great. I think if you have the right attitude, you can't go to it saying, I'm going to see a fantastic play. You have to go into, this will be interesting.
But I know you would love for your brother Michael to see it.
Yeah, so because Michael's a big tennis player. And I think if someone's a big tennis player, the tennis stuff is so compelling. And I don't mean it in a sports way. I mean, there's a lot of mental aspects of the game that are explored here in a very intelligent way. And I think someone who was a very successful, competitive, highly ranked tennis player, they'd get a lot out of it. Yeah. So I recommend it to Michael.
The Last Match.
The Last Match.
Anna Ziegler.
Right.
Right. At Pell's with Roundabout Theater. Okay, so let's see. What else is going on in the Wall Street Journal this week? A review of two books by Leonardo da Vinci.
Yeah.
Okay? Two.
Only two.
Two in one article. And, you know, I did mention Walter Isaacson's book last week. So the only reason I'm mentioning it again is because this review, you know, kind of takes Isaacson to task a little bit.
Good.
Compares it with another book that he's interested in. And so the reviewer is Daniel Levitin, who is the Dean of Arts and Humanities at the Keck Graduate Institute and also a faculty fellow at Berkeley School of Business. So that's an interesting combination of interests in alone. Walter Isaacson, he says, describes Leonardo as history's most creative genius, which Levitin urges Isaacson to, you know, you might want to be a little cautious about that kind of grand statement. But he does say that Isaacson, you know, does a good job of showing us how Leonardo, as a genius, used his scientific explorations to inform his art.
Right.
And did things like
sketches?
No, when you cut somebody up.
Yeah, surgery?
No.
I feel like we're on a game show.
In biology class.
Yeah.
What's it called?
Dissection?
Dissection.
Oh, I see.
He actually dissected cadavers so he could understand the musculature, the bone structure, etc. And even changed some of his drawings, paintings, etc. over time to reflect an improved understanding of, oh, it was not one muscle, it was actually two there, and so the neck looks a little bit different.
Yeah, so when he's drawing not dissections, but real people, they're more realistic.
Because yeah, but they're informed by those dissections.
I got it.
Okay.
Okay.
But anyway, Levitin describes Mr. Isaacson concluding that Leonardo was a genius undisciplined by diligence. I mean, and it's true. He did have issues with getting things done on time.
Uh-huh.
Isaac says he actually was successful at theatrical productions, putting on theatrical productions, and because those had to happen at a particular time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're doing an altarpiece for somebody's church. You know, that process could go on forever.
Mm-hmm.
The play must go on when it must go on.
It was overbooked.
That was his one deadline. They say he may have been just the greatest procrastinator of all time. Nonetheless, Levitin sums up, well, let me introduce the other book first, and that's a book by Mike Langford, who's an author, not an art historian or a research expert, but a writer, okay? And he wrote a book called becoming Leonardo, and he tries to put Leonardo in his context of the time,
right,
when and where he grew up. And why are there no more Leonardos? Mr. Lankford asks. I think the truth is there are potential Leonardos everywhere in the world, but they rarely survive or succeed in our regimented social order, and they don't do well on tests. A kid growing up wild in the country today, 15 years old and unable to properly write or even sign his name, as was true of Leonardo apparently when he was 15, is what social welfare workers would call a problem. Okay. He's putting Leonardo into the context of the time, the limitations of the time, the needs of the time, and saying he could only have happened, his genius could only have happened at that moment.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Mr. Lankford is writing of Leonardo as a man of his time, Mr. Isaacson as a man for all time.
Mm-hmm.
The differences between these books couldn't be more striking. With Mr. Isaacson, opinions are presented as facts, and conjecture masquerades as knowledge. Throughout most of their books, Levitin says, I found Mr. Lankford's writing thought-provoking and Mr. Isaacson's thought-stifling.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So we're going for the Lankford Leonardo book.
That seems to be what Mr. Levitin's opinion is.
Yeah,
true. Okay. And, you know, it might be pretty interesting because he really does try to create for you that context,
okay,
of how Leonardo was living and surviving and doing, given the limitations of the 15th century.
Well, there was another Wall Street Journal article about the founder of art history, and you've already told me he's not the founder of art history.
I don't know if art history, really? It's a review of The Collector of Lives by Ingrid Rowland and Noah Charney. The review is by Cami Brothers, who's an associate professor at Northeastern University. And The Collector of Lives turns out to be Vasari. Okay, Giorgio Vasari,
mm-hmm,
who wrote The Lives of the Artists. And it's him we thank for our fascination with biography of artists.
Mm-hmm.
And to some extent, perhaps it's him we thank for our understanding of who was great in the Renaissance, how the Renaissance came about, how it came about in Florence, okay, Vasari's town, etc. So there are limitations because of that. It, you know, sounds like a pretty interesting book. Cami, Ms. Brothers, not overly won over by this discussion of Vasari, and actually at the end of the article recommends you might want to go back to Vasari himself. It's a pretty good read in itself. And of course, I mean, well, enough about Vasari. Enough about.
All right. Did you want to mention the Modigliani?
Oh, yeah. I should have mentioned that when I was talking about being at the Met.
Yeah.
One of my students who is an adult student, actually, took the time to scamper around to some other museums, etc., while she and her husband, and this is Carolyn and Gadi Naaman, zoomed up to the Jewish Museum before they came to the Met, and they report that the Modigliani exhibition is really terrific.
Okay.
And so anybody's interested in that and the connection with his abstractions of the human body and face and how they relate to African masks, Egyptian art, etc., will find it quite fascinating.
Good. Good. All right. So a couple of sports heroes passed away. And the common theme there is that they both did not have the opportunity to achieve greatness early in their career, only later. And if you think about the way sports goes, especially now, that's not the way it works. Either you hit it when you're 19 or 20 or you don't
right.
hit it.
Right.
So they're different stories. The first is Connie Hawkins. Connie Hawkins was a what they used to call a playground legend. He was a great basketball player. He was amazingly acrobatic on the playgrounds of New York. And he was destined to be a star. He was going to go to the University of Iowa after starring in high school basketball. And he was accused of point shaving, you know, fixing games, mm-hmm. not winning by a certain amount so that mm-hmm. gamblers might profit. It was never really proven, but it was enough that the NBA said, well, we don't really need to get involved with Connie Hawkins. And Iowa said, we don't need to get involved in Connie Hawkins. And suddenly he wasn't playing. He had no college career to speak of. He was not drafted or employed by the NBA. Here's where the lawyers step in as heroes. The lawyers, as always, step in and sue on his behalf. They sue the NBA. And they win, they say it's a violation that the NBA got together and all the owners didn't employ him. And they win more than $1 million, which is real money back then. Mm-hmm. And this takes some years, of course. And mm-hmm. after playing 1 year in the ABA, which is kind of fledgling at that time, he is put into the NBA at the age of 27. Mm-hmm. 27 for basketball is a little late to the game. Right. Okay? And yet he does well because he was so great, right? Mm-hmm. So he averages over 20 points a game. I think it's 24 points a game in his first season. He has a number of successful seasons. He's elected to the Basketball Hall of Fame. He has such a good career. Really? And yet, even though he's elected to the Basketball Hall of Fame, his story is people constantly saying, you should have seen the young Connie. Even in the Basketball Hall of Fame. So later, what you have is Julius Erving. And Julius Erving comes up. Everybody says they've never seen anything like it. The swooping dunks, the great movement underneath the basket. And Bob Lanier and players like that said, young Connie. Should have seen young Connie. Yeah. So, and yet he said, I'm not complaining. Worked out for me. But made it at the age of 27. The other is a man named Y.A. Tittle. Yelberton Abraham Tittle, who was nothing less than perhaps the most important athlete in the history of New York sports. And certainly the greatest football player in the history of New York sports. And I say that in part to be provocative because perhaps most people haven't heard of him. But it's true.
Well, I never heard of him until I met you. Well, you don't know Y.A. Tittle.
You don't know Y.A. Tittle.
And of course, I never forgot it.
And I still married you. That's the kind of broad-minded guy. Look, Y.A. Tittle, there are three things to keep in mind with Y.A. Tittle. Y.A. Tittle, the football player.
Right.
There's Y.A. Tittle, the insurance salesman. And there's Y.A. Tittle, the photograph.
Yeah,
and
right. That is an iconic.
So here's the way it goes.
So Google the photograph.
Now I'm going to get to that. Then they can order. Number one, Y.A. Tittle. We're talking about guys who did not come into their own until late in the game. Y.A. Tittle played many years on the West Coast. Played for the San Francisco 49ers with no success. Wasn't always the starter. Played behind people like John Brody and even Billy Kilmer. And at the age of 34.
34.
Right. Is traded to the New York Giants.
Elderly.
He's traded to the New York Giants for an offensive lineman who nobody heard of. Now, people in football kind of knew how skilled he was, even though he hadn't gotten the chance. So much so that when the offensive lineman was traded for him, he actually said to the press, me? For Tittle? He comes over to the Giants just at the time that the Giants are a pretty good team and a fellow named Charlie Connolly is about to retire. He's been their quarterback. And Tittle leads that team to unbelievable success 3 straight years, 1961, 62, and 63. Get this. Each one of those years, the Giants go to the championship game with Tittle as their quarterback. In 1963, one of those years, Tittle is the most valuable player of the entire league. Not only that, but Tittle sets not once, but twice the NFL record for touchdown passes. Now, here's why that's important. There are records and there are records. The records for touchdown passes is only held by great quarterbacks. It was broken finally by Dan Marino It was next broken by Peyton Manning and then Tom Brady. That's who has that record. Mm-hmm. Those mm-hmm. are that kind of quarterbacks. He was great.
And so that's what made him great? No, the passing?
Yeah, the passing. The passing made him great, but the question is, why? Why? How was he so successful? Because he looked, as you well know, Tamsin, like a guy who's not 34, but 54. He wasn't athletic looking. He didn't have the strongest arm in the world. He was balding. He was a little bit gimpy. And yet he had this amazing success. And the question is why?
So I'm the edge of my seat.
I have the answer for you.
Okay.
Okay. The answer is Till was one of the first quarterbacks to read defenses. Tittle figured out, based on his experience, okay, they didn't have computers then, they didn't have that much film then, all right? Mm-hmm. He, based on experience and his observance of the defense player's behavior, he knew what they were going to do, and in those days, the quarterback called the plays, all right? So he killed these defenses. I went back to an article written in Sports Illustrated in 1963, and here's what it says. The Tittle instinctive approach to the art of signal calling makes him very difficult for opposing defenses. All teams chart the frequency with which opposing quarterbacks call certain plays. Since Tittle himself is seldom sure what he's going to do next, defensive signal callers despair of outguessing him. He was miles ahead mentally mm-hmm. from the other players in the game. Now, I warned you, I may read a line from this, but it gets a little technical. And here's how he explains it in 1963. He says, look, let's say I'm looking at the safety, and instead of being relaxed and at ease, he's crouched over. And maybe he's moved up a step or two to the line of scrimmage. I read blitz. That means the weak side linebacker, not the safety, another player is coming, and the safety is going to have to cover the receiver the linebacker would otherwise have to cover. Since I know it's a blitz, I keep in a running back to block the blitz. I know the receiver can beat the safety, and there's my play. Whoosh. Okay,
now my head. Fine. But right. Perhaps our listeners
but here's the
understand
other
football
but
better
the other
than
thing
I
to
do.
Know about Tittle is, you know, his career was so more so when he was in California, he started working hard as an insurance agent. Mm-hmm. And even in that same interview with Sports Illustrated 63, he talks about selling insurance. Mm-hmm. And he says, this is Sports Illustrated, it's a lot like football. He says, you learn a presentation and work on it until you know it cold. Then after 15 or so years, you begin to know what you're doing. Okay? So here's a quarterback insurance agent who's setting the league on fire. He's the MVP in a league in which Jim Brown is playing. Mm-hmm. He's the MVP. It doesn't make any sense. And then in 1964, it all comes to an end. It's like Cinderella and the clock strikes 12. Mm-hmm. First game doesn't go well. And in the second game, Tittle is hit hard by a defensive lineman named Jim Baker, 6'7", 280 pounds. And he goes flying to the ground, and there is this iconic photograph taken. The Times describes it this way. Tamsin knows the photograph. She's looking at it now. Tittle kneeling, his shoulders drooped, his helmet knocked off, his bald pate exposed, his face bloodied.
Mm.
That photograph.
It's pretty evocative.
It's an unbelievable photograph. It hangs in three important places. It hangs in the Pro Football Hall of Fame.
Okay.
In which it indicates to people, in a sense, how brutal the sport actually is and what it is, the old warrior. I mean, Tittle doesn't look like a football player. He looks like an insurance agent who's dressed as a football player,
okay.
Right?
Yeah.
It was used by John Baker, who himself ran for sheriff in his town. Right? And he basically said, this is what little John is going to do for crime in the county.
Okay.
Tough guy.
Yeah.
But more than anything, it hangs in the Y.A. Tittle Insurance Agency in California, which has become enormously successful selling to Silicon Valley firms. Hangs there with the legend, nothing comes easy. Y.A. Tittle.
Y.A. Tittle. So another great or fun review in the Wall Street Journal this weekend was the review of a book called The Butchering Art by Lindsay Fitzharris, written by Dr. Ross, a physician. John J. Ross, a physician, and author of Shakespeare's Tremor and Orwell's Cough. What, says Dr. Ross, was the most dangerous place in the vast territories of the British Empire in the 19th century? Was it the savage savannas of Zululand, perhaps the frozen wastes of the Northwest Passage, or the treacherous high passes of the Hindu Kush? To judge from The Butchering Art, a fine and long overdue biography of the great physician Joseph Lister by Lindsay Fitzharris, the answer might be a much more domestic corner of the empire, the Victorian Teaching Hospital. Hospitals of the era were factories of death, where patients came in with trauma and were brought out for burial. Oof. They were really filthy, and apparently there was still, during the early half of the 19th century, they still sort of felt that disease was spread by air, mm-hmm. by things in the atmosphere, mm-hmm. as opposed to germs.
Right.
And so you would go in these hospitals and they were completely filthy. All right. And so Lister's family is depressed, is sad when he sets out to be a surgeon. Mm-hmm. Surgery was considered at the low end, mm-hmm. of being a physician in general. And he ends up being a great surgeon, and he, you know, is pretty fascinated and obsessed by Louis Pasteur's experiments suggesting that germs, mm-hmm. are responsible for infection. And he comes across an idea to use carbolic acid to clean things, to clean instruments, mm-hmm. Surfaces, the air. And when he does that, he ends up reducing infection. You know, pretty much all surgery resulted in infection, which resulted in amputation. Mm-hmm. He ends up reducing amputation rate to about 9%. Mm-hmm. And so he is quite successful, quite amazing. And one of the interesting statements, the Germans become quite won over by this concept of antisepsis. Mm-hmm. And the Scotch use it to some extent. England comes along eventually. Only one nation, Miss Fitzharris reports, remained unconvinced of the merits of Lister's methods, the United States, where Harvard's Henry Jacob Bigelow derided antisepsis as medical hocus pocus.
Right.
And so it says, Lister won over many of his opponents, not with bile and rhetoric, but with relentless focus on data and results. Hmm. Of course, most of who he wins over, he focused greatly on medical students themselves,
right.
Realizing that you get most of your converts, sure. in the next generation,
right.
the older ones who don't believe in it die out. So that, if you're interested in disease and the advancements of surgery during the 19th century, sounds like a fun book.
Yeah, that is interesting. It's a little grisly. Okay, so Richard Thaler won the Nobel Prize for economics. And the question is, what is his theory about and how has he advanced it? And as described in the headline, The Times, he is an expert in harnessing the power of irrational behavior. And one of his points was, and this is not his alone, is that there are two kinds of people. Thaler had over the years divided the population into econs and humans. Econs are economically rational people, a tiny percentage of the population who fit the standard model that economists use. Humans or the rest of us. Now,
so are you an econ and I'm a human? Is that what we're getting at here?
You're married to an econ. And now
you are not.
And this tells me for the first time that the rest of the people aren't econs. Now, I thought you, Tamsin, were the only non-econ around, but it turns out there are others who are non-econs. And so, fine. Is that a big deal?
Wait, should I know who Richard Thaler is?
No, not necessarily. I mean, he's an economist, and it's not like he's...
And you econs know about him.
Nah, not particularly. Actually, he's not my favorite guy, but because I don't actually... I'm not a huge fan of rational behavior economics, and I'll tell you why in just a moment. The Times sort of puts their finger on a little bit. Times says this, and they're right. Mainstream economics was built on the simplifying assumption that people behave rationally, all right? But it's not news. It's not news that that's not the case. What you have to do is not simply argue that humans are irrational, because everybody knows that. It's always seemed obvious. It's not particularly helpful.
Okay.
Rather, what Thaler and others try to show is that people depart from rationality in consistent ways so that their behavior can be anticipated and modeled. That the Times is putting their finger on it. That's the point.
Mm-hmm.
The point is, the great thing that you see in economics books is they have a model mm-hmm. that you can say, you can predict people's behavior, and it's based on rationality. But the key thing is modeling future behavior. It's not enough to say people are irrational. You need a different model.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And if Thaler had come up with an alternative model, Thaler and others like him,
mm-hmm.
I'd say that's pretty impressive. He hasn't.
Mm-hmm.
He's made, you know, I read quite a bit about Thaler's work in connection with this. And frankly, they've made progress, but not a lot of progress. There is no alternative model. There are little stabs. There's a long way to go.
So you're saying take away the prize?
I'm not interested in who gets the Nobel Prize one way or another. I'm saying that I'm not bowled over by his research. And in fact, in some ways, it gets muddled. And I'll give you one quick example, all right? You know, when you deal with surge pricing, and people complain about surge pricing,
mm-hmm.
right? Well, the early Thaler said people shouldn't complain about surge pricing because it encourages rational behavior, supply where you need it. It's only if you have higher prices during tough circumstances, even hurricanes, that people come forward with the goods that are necessary to fill the gaps. Otherwise, mm-hmm. they don't have the incentive to do it and develop those resources. Later in life, Thaler's writing saying, well, but people want fairness. They want fairness. So maybe you get rid of surge pricing. Yeah, but that doesn't answer the question is how are you going to get people to supply the goods absent the surge pricing? So it just feels like he's going soft. But in any event, that's the issue. You had something about...
The latest Gabrielle Hamilton
right.
Column in the Times Magazine section.
Right.
And she's writing about cooking duck breast, actually. Mm. And we won't go into that, but she has one great quote.
She said you can do it at home.
Fine. Okay.
Think about that. Right. Think about that.
That's not what is great about the article.
No, for me, that's what's great about the article.
And the article is actually titled Cooking Like a Cynic. And she talks about, some of the ways chefs talk in terms of menu planning. A certain level of cynicism and a dose of jadedness expressed most commonly when it comes to menu planning time in the observation, she says, you could throw your grandmother on the grill with goat cheese and artichokes and sell 1,000 plates a night.
That is cynical.
But it is kind of a wonderful phrase, and she continues to be a terrific modern food writer.
It's hard to top that, but and I can't really. But there was one thing that sort of jumped out at me. There was an obituary of a fellow named Bob Schiller, who's a TV writer for comedies, and he worked with Lucille Ball and worked on All in the Family. But what attracted my attention was the end of the obituary, and there was a question as to where he got his comedic chops from. And he said, from my dad. I said, my mother was good with grammar, but my dad was famous for a two-word joke. And he asked, for example, he said, well, my mother once said to him, tell me, when you die, do you want to be buried or cremated? He responded, surprise me. So, two-word joke. That's all we have. Time to then read the paper. We'll see you next week.
After we get some rest.
Yes.
Yes. Good night.